Sounds True presents Laws That Change Lives, Tape 2. My name is Tammy Simon, and I'll be your host as our program continues with an interview with Dan Millman. The title of this program is Laws That Change Lives, and I'm curious about this word change and how much people really change in a lifetime. You know, there's so much transformational material, and yet when I look at people I've known over 20, 30 years, they seem very much the same to me. And I'm curious, how much do people really change, Dan?
We have to change, just like leaves falling loose in autumn. Most of us would look back on our lives and look at us as children and acknowledge we've changed a great deal. We've grown, we've learned. And yet Ram Dass, who's acknowledged as one of the wise sages of our time, he once said, I have every neurosis I ever had in my life, despite all the experiences I've done. And I already mentioned the story previously about Aldous Huxley. With all the studying he did, all the practices, he still, all he'd learned really was just to be a little bit kinder. He didn't even say a lot kinder. So I think change is a tremendous challenge for anyone. In my own life, I've still seen therapists to deal with very practical life-level issues of relationship. So I don't think it's a matter of changing so radically one has it all together. I believe we do change, but I think even small changes can make a vast difference in our lives. A small shift of perception, of seeing things a little different way, it doesn't show, it can't be measured. But I think they make a huge difference in life. And, you know, there's something even suspect, even when I've written things about changing and it's good to help you change, maybe we don't need to change. Maybe we just need to completely accept and love who we are. But the paradox is, once we do that, that tends to create a shift anyway.
Are there things that you do in your life in order to remember these laws? Do you have little reminders? Do you put Post-its up on the refrigerator or hanging from your car rearview mirror?
No, actually, I don't. There's a danger of taking any teachings, whether spiritual or otherwise, and create slogans of them. And so our conscious mind goes around knowing all these things and having these slogans and strategy planning sessions. And I've lived my life more intuitively. And so I'm reminded of these laws of spirit or any other principles of living when I most need it. When I notice my wife and I are having an argument, that's when I go, what's out of balance here? Could I practice surrender? And sometimes I have the free attention to remember these things. And sometimes I don't. Sometimes I just get wrapped up in the argument. And it's not until later on when I kind of do a debrief, what went on, what happened here, that I go, oh yeah, I still have work to do in this area. So that's how life teaches us, and that's how I'm still learning too.
Now, you mentioned that there are an infinite number of laws, and yet you've presented 12. And I can imagine people could come up with all kinds of humorous laws of spirit or various kinds of, you know, ramifications. I mean, you just mentioned intuition. Well, maybe the law of intuition is a law of spirit.
Sure. That would also apply to the law of faith. Intuition is a part in trusting oneself. Sure, there's the law of love. Many people ask, why don't you say the law of love? Why isn't that one of your laws?
But yeah, why isn't that one of your laws?
Well, now that you asked, actually I find that we talk a lot about love. Love is the way, and love your brother and your sister as yourself, and love your neighbor as yourself, and love is the truth, and so on. A lot of talk is done about love, but being able to do it, being able to have our attention rise like a bubble through the ocean, up through the chakras, the energy centers, into the heart, until that's true, until our attention is really coming from our heart, we're not really loving. We're doing other things we call love. There's so many words for different meanings. When someone applies any of the laws, the law of compassion, the law of integrity, the law of presence, that frees our attention, so we begin to love more naturally and spontaneously. So it's not a matter of having to go around following a law of love. It won't do any good until we practice some of the other laws in our life. Love just manifests quite naturally at that point.
So you picked these 12 laws as the ones you wanted to represent for some reason. You thought this was the best way to represent an infinite number of possibilities.
These are the ones I came up with. In The Life You Were Born to Live, I have 17 laws in that book, but they're related more specifically to the different life paths and birth numbers in that particular book. I was going to do 17 laws, but then they somehow, in the organic, natural process, that intuitive process of putting together a new book with its own energy, they just ended up getting distilled down to 12. I did not do that number deliberately by any means. It just came out to 12.
Is there something special about the number 12?
Well, you know, several truths have struck me. One is that nothing means anything in life. And that is profoundly liberating because it means we make up our meanings. We can make up life as we go along. People can give whys and reasons they do things and create meanings. So I could say, yes, 12 is very meaningful and related to the 12 months of the year and astrologically and every other way. As a matter of fact, I have a future book I'll be working on whose title is not decided upon, but the subtitle is going to be Opening the 12 Gateways to Human Potential. And it happened to be 12. Someone else might come up with 20 or distill it down to 6, but it came out 12. And it's not correlated directly to the 12 laws that we talked about. But there are 12 gateways, 12 arenas of human life that we're all working on beneath the surface of life, and that will be a future project perhaps we'll be talking about sometime.
The 12 gateways, the way you access this kind of information, this comes to you through your intuition?
Not always. In a sense, we're all synthesizers, and everything I've read or heard forms an impression. It's like there are hundreds of thousands of quotations, and I've collected 300 or so over the years. And so I was a filter to take those quotations that felt most germane to life. Someone else might collect different ones. And so, yes, much of it is my intuition. I sat down, I asked Spirit, in a sense, I just kind of asked the question internally, what are we working on in life? And boom, 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 it just came up. And I tried to think of more, I couldn't. And I've given talks all over the world on these 12 gateways, and nobody's come up with another one. It just seemed to come out that way. I wouldn't argue that there are only 12. It's just what I've come up with.
You started your talk with this idea of the point of leverage as you were tossed back onto the ground by the character of Socrates. And I'm curious, in your own life, where do you get the most leverage on a daily basis to live according to the principles that you wish to live by?
Well, it's funny. Despite my speaking of the law of choices, that we can always make choices in life, I feel like, to me, it's the only choice that feels viable. Ever since I was young, even before I could articulate it, my greatest motivation in life was to make a difference in the world, to have it count for something. When I was a gymnast, I found I enjoyed helping someone else learn a movement even more than learning it myself. I love sharing things. In the same spirit, somebody might watch a movie or read a good book and want to share it with a friend that they care about. I care about everybody. And that sounds, you know, self-serving and sweet, but it's just my reality. So I love to share. And anything I've learned in my life, from whatever source, I translate it, I express it in my own way, to see if I can say it in such a way that does exert leverage to actually help people see their life, the bigger picture of their life, in a different way. You know, I've felt lonely at times because I've never really associated myself with a particular lineage. Someone can't say, oh, Dan Millman, yeah, he's a Hindu. You know, he's a yogi. Dan, oh, he's a Buddhist. He's a Taoist. He's a Christian, a Jew. Or Dan's a scientist. He's a PhD. I don't have any lineage to hang on to identify with. In a sense, it's been freeing as well, because I'm sort of the Bruce Lee of spiritual teachings. I use whatever works. I don't have to align myself with a particular dogma. And just recently, I've realized that I associate most closely with the American Transcendentalist movement, Emerson and Thoreau, who just remind people of the bigger picture of life.
So the leverage for you then comes from this vision that you have of your contribution and what inspires you.
Yes. Despite, someone once said, one sign of impending nervous breakdown is to consider one's work terribly important. So I try to keep a perspective, you know, that there's one light in the world, but there are many lamps, and I'm just shining it as best I can while I can.
You know, I think I understand what you're saying, because I think it's the same thing that inspires me on a daily basis. But the interesting thing is that I know a lot of people who feel frustrated because they have an instinct. They want to be of service, and yet they want to apply, let's say, your law of process, but they're not quite sure where they're going, what the vision is, what their contribution is.
Well, that's one reason I wrote The Life You Were Born to Live, to help people kind of clarify some of the major issues they have, the hurdles they're here to overcome, and also the inherent talents and potential they have. And I know many people like that who say, I want to help. I know I'm here to do something, but what is it? And yet, that's where the law of faith comes in. that wherever we step, the path is going to appear beneath our feet if we just follow our nose and trust the timing and the law of cycles to apply that law as well. Maybe it's not going to appear for another 6 months or a year or 10 years. But just to trust each day, to follow instincts, go where one is attracted, because we're here to do not what other people think we ought to do, but what we're drawn toward, moment to moment, day to day. We'll all discover what we're here to do. We'll find it. We can't not find it unless we really, really shut our eyes tight. We eventually stumble somehow into our calling. I feel very blessed to have found mine, and by around 40 years of age, I realized that I'm going to be writing books for the time being and lecturing, sharing in that way. And yet, it's not a matter of everybody having to become a lecturer, an author, or anything like that. Mother Teresa once said, we can't all do great things, but we can do small things with great love. And so, we can all make a difference for other people. Maybe it's a smile to somebody in the street. I got a letter from one person, at least I remember, who said they were very, very close to suicide, until someone walking down the street turned to them and smiled and said, hey, have a nice day. Now, that may not seem like a big deal. That person, I'm sure, had no idea they were saving a life in giving someone a smile. So that's very powerful. It doesn't have to be standing up before a group of people and lecturing. We all have to find our own path, what our own gifts are.
You mentioned the law of faith, that as we take a step, that we know eventually we're being, let's say, guided or moved, that our life is unfolding in the direction that it should. And it seems to me that, as you were talking, that's one of the laws that I see people misunderstanding. I'm sure all the laws can be misapplied as well as intelligently applied, but specifically with the law of faith, you know, you get a flat tire and you say, well, I was going to get in a car accident. It's really good that I got a flat tire, but what if it's, you know, I really needed to put air in my tires? This kind of bias towards interpreting everything
yes.
in a positive way can
right.
get incredibly annoying.
I agree with you completely. Let me give an example. I was giving a lecture in Columbia, Maryland, when a tree fell over in the parking lot in midwinter and crushed four people's cars. Now, everyone was inside. No one was hurt, but the cars were smashed pretty well, just about totaled. One of the gentlemen had just bought a new Porsche, which was crushed, and he was holding his guts like it. It really was him the tree had fallen on. He identified so closely with the car. But that wasn't, it really was an inconvenience, you know. I mean, he'd have to call around, call the insurance company, and so on. But the most interesting response was a woman whose car had been crushed, who had done a lot of psychological, spiritual seminars and so on, and she was pacing back and forth going, what's the lesson in this? I know there's a lesson in this. There's got to be a lesson. Then a big bird flew by the window, a big crow or raven. She'd been reading maybe too much Carlos Castaneda, and she said, oh, that was an omen. I knew it. What it meant was I shouldn't have been here today. I had a little doubt whether I should have come. If I hadn't, my car would be okay. Well, maybe that was the meaning. Maybe that was the lesson for her. But, you know, it strikes me that healthy people make up healthy lessons or meanings, and neurotic people make up neurotic meanings for things. So when I use the example in the law of faith that maybe my flat tire saved me down the road, you're right, it just makes up a saying to make one feel better. And yet, isn't that better than how come God's punishing me? Which makes someone feel better. We don't know what's true. A flat tire is just a flat tire, and you get out and you fix it. And maybe the meaning is you learn how to fix a flat tire, or you learned a little patience, or you experienced a little adversity that wasn't so bad.
How do you respond to a sentence like this? A bad thing happened to me today. Do you think that person is misperceiving what's occurred?
I think the paradox are different levels of reality. On a conventional level, people will say, this was good, this was bad. Someone gave me some money, that was good. Someone ran into my car, that was bad. And conventionally speaking, well, certainly. If you have 1,000 people, most people will agree that it's better having someone give you money than having your car hit by somebody. But when you jump to a higher level, then things aren't that cut and dried. Maybe getting hit by a car can change your life in ways that having someone give you some money wouldn't. I shattered my leg in 40 places in a motorcycle accident some years ago. I wrote about that in Way of the Peaceful Warrior. And that turned out, looking back, as one of the most profound life-transforming experiences I'd ever had. Because it shook me up. I'm pointing up right now. I started really asking deeper questions about life. What is life really about? My God, I'm really vulnerable. I could have been killed. And it set me on a different path, like a railroad switcher. I was off on a different track at that point. That's what really opened my life up. I don't recommend seeking such a thing or I don't recommend broken legs or injuries as a method. But good or bad, there was a story in Way of the Peaceful Warrior, an old man and his son who lived in a very poor farm, and a horse ran away, and all the neighbors said, "What bad luck." Oh, and the farmer said, "Who knows whether good luck or bad luck." A week later, the horse came back, leading 5 wild stallions into the corral. And all the neighbors said, "What great fortune." And he said, "Well, who knows, good luck, bad luck, you know." And soon after that, the son was trying to tame one of the wild horses and broke his leg. And the neighbors said, "Oh, wow, a terrible fortune." Farmer said, "Good luck, bad luck, who knows." Well, the army came at that time to conscript all the young men for war, a war he almost certainly would have been killed in, but they couldn't take the son because his leg was broken. Good luck, bad luck. So at that level, it's hard to know for sure and be so certain what's good and what's bad. And that's the point, of course, of the story.
In speaking of the book, The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, you introduced a little in your talk the character of Socrates, and I'm sure anybody who's read that book has the question, now, is this a real human being that you met while you were at college and studied with, or did you create this as a fictional character?
Sure, sure. Well, before I respond, let me say there are so many illusions in what we call the New Age. Many people need to discriminate between reality, what works and what doesn't. Questions arise, are subliminal tapes really effective, are affirmations really effective, and some people believe a crystal will do wonders in their life by putting it on their counter. And we need to start to see what, you know, in a sense, keep our head in the clouds but our feet on the ground. So I don't want to add to the illusions, and even though I left things a bit mysterious in Way of the Peaceful Warrior, how much was true and how much wasn't, I'm very happy to clarify that. The old man I called Socrates was based on an actual flesh-and-blood, real old man I met at about 3 in the morning after a late-night date in an old Texaco station on the corner of Oxford and Hearst in Berkeley, California. He was a cosmic old guy. In fact, I've seen some other people who've attended my lectures who actually knew him, too.
Uh-huh.
He's since, I'm quite sure, has passed away. The station's been torn down a number of years ago, but he was based on a real old man. That doesn't mean every word in the book was factual, however. I mean, Socrates could not jump up on rooftops. Come on, please. He did not grab me by the head and send me off on journeys. That would be terrible. We'd have to go around looking for head grabbers. We've all had visions and journeys and insights in our life, whether we discount them or remember them or not, in the dream state and in various times in our life. So I use some fictional elements and chronology changes, as I said in the preface, to convey a story that would help convey lessons about life. It's more accurate to say it was based on a true story with some fictional elements than it would be to say it was simply fiction.
Now, you've mentioned that Socrates was based on a real white-haired person at a gas station, but you've probably had other teachers as well, is that right?
Yes, I have had a number of influences in my life, different human teachers, who have been very, very useful, and I have tremendous gratitude to all of them. But in recent years, I've spent less time and I've been less inclined to talk about them by name. My primary reason is when I say this person was one of my teachers, many people who have enjoyed my work take that as an automatic endorsement. And those teachers who were so wonderful for me at the time may not be wonderful for me today. And they certainly might not be perfect for someone else. I feel just as I described how we pick books in the library or bookstore, there's a process that I respect very much where each person, whatever their needs are at the time, whatever lessons they need to learn, they need to pick their own teachers. I teach a martial arts training, a knife fighting training. It's a mystical training that uses rubber knives as a means to access some internal resources. And when I teach that, at the end, people get so enthusiastic about martial arts, even if they've never taken one, they say, "Well, what's the best martial art?" And all I can recommend to them is that they look in the Yellow Pages, visit schools in their practical driving distance, and get a feel for the school, what works best for them. The teacher is more important than the art, than the style. If there's a teacher they really like who seems to have a sense of the bigger picture, that could be very useful to work with. But there's no one teacher good for everybody, no one book good for everybody, no one teaching. So that's why I don't really talk about my teachers. They were right for me at the time, and each of us has to find the teachers that are right for us at the time. And again, they're not necessarily human teachers. They may be our cat. They may be a baby in our environment. They may be an adversary. The lessons are all around us.
Now, that book, The Way of the Peaceful Warrior, made an incredible impact on people and sold over 1 million copies. Do you have an idea why it was so popular now in retrospect, looking back at it?
You know, I haven't really given it much thought because the book's done, it's out there, and whether I make up a meaning for it or not doesn't really matter. I didn't strategically set out and analyze how I would write a book to have such an impact. I just wrote what was in my heart. It's the same way I speak. I just thought maybe some college students would like it. I wrote my experiences, the true experiences in my life, internal experiences, my realizations and understandings about life, and I shared them through a story based on my life. Maybe it helps some people see the bigger picture of their life, to see things in perspective. Maybe it gave people a sense of okayness, that they were all right where they were in their process, by seeing Mia, kind of a smart alecky young gymnast who had to learn to be a fool. It just amazes me how people say this reflects my life or it came at the right time for me. Every day, like I feel like Candide, you know, in Voltaire's story, Candide, just an innocent abroad staring into mystery. I feel blessed many times over, and I'm just so happy that I wrote something that had that kind of impact.
Now, your book, The Laws of Spirit, is also presented in a parable format. Is there something about the parable format that particularly works for you or that you think communicates spiritual laws better than other formats?
Well, let me digress for a moment to talk about a second book, which is The Sacred Journey of the Peaceful Warrior, which is a story also. Now, that book is a novel, and I even said it in italics in the preface. People want it to be all true. But Mama Chia, the character in that book, was a composite of different women I've known and still continue to meet. And the story is largely a novel to convey certain spiritual models and understandings. Whereas The Laws of Spirit, yes, it's not a full-blown novel, of course. It's a parable, and the reason I use that structure is an earlier draft of the book simply wrote out the laws and told one after the other. But again, it's this constant inner drive I have to really make a difference, and I felt that wasn't the best way to convey the material. When people learn lessons through life, through experience, even if it's vicarious experience, I think it carries deeper. It's like chelating vitamins. The lessons are absorbed at a different level, a visceral level, an emotional level, not just mental, rather than just reading principles. So I think it comes alive in a different way. My next book is going to be a novel.
I'm wondering if there's any of the spiritual laws that are particularly difficult for you, that you really struggle with yourself.
Maybe it depends what time of day you catch me.
In the morning.
They're all a challenge. Balance is a challenge. Choices, taking full responsibility for every moment that happens to me. I'm getting better at that one. But I think it's less important what I find difficult than what each listener finds difficult, because that's what they can benefit from the most. You know, I teach an exercise series, a 4-minute exercise routine, and I tell people that the exercise in the routine that's the most difficult for an individual is the one they stand to benefit from the most, because that's their weak area. So any listener, if they have a particular problem with one law, that's where to put the attention. And for me, you know, sure, I could say there are 3 or 4 or 5 I'm working on all the time, particularly. This isn't a burden. This makes life interesting. It's not a matter of, oh my goodness, how many laws do I have to work on today? My brow is sweaty. It's not like that. It makes life interesting. It gives us something to do, really constructive, all the time. And it reminds us of the bigger picture of our life. Because our life will not depend on how much money we make next week. That's all very good, you know. Or if we happen to be getting along real well with our partner. What's going to make a difference in our life as we look back is, how well did I align my life with reality? What did I learn about why I'm really here? And these laws are a constant connection to us. They bridge science and mysticism, realism and idealism. They're a constant connection to the larger picture of our lives.
Now, can you say more what you mean by this word align, aligning yourself? Because it seems like that is the point that you're making, is that there's
sure.
a way to align oneself.
Sure. The laws of spirit are not here for us. In a sense, we're here for them. They simply describe reality. I use the analogy of a river, a deep river. When you're swimming in the river, you can either swim upstream or downstream, and it's as simple as that. Aligning ourselves with a law is another way of saying applying it in our life. But the way you apply it is you recognize it, you see its wisdom, and you begin to live in alignment with that law.
You've used this metaphor of going with the waters of the laws of spirit versus swimming against the stream. Do you think that's something you always kind of know when you're swimming against the stream or not, that you can feel it?
I think if it were obvious to us, I think it would be easier for people to swim with the current of life. And it's a metaphor that's been used many, many, many times. I mean, go with the flow has become a cliche.
It's a very useful, beautiful metaphor.
Well, it's a natural metaphor.
Right.
And as I pointed out in the laws of spirit, see, nature is my teacher. It's a hologram. Every lesson, every valuable fundamental law of nature and lesson we need to learn about life, we can go up to the mountains, and if our eyes are open, we can learn them. It's all there. It's a little bit hidden. Once I learned a lesson that changed my life in a very small but very real way. I was an administrator working at a desk. My desk was piled with papers, and I was feeling that blood rising to my head, getting the speediness kind of, trying to get everything done, three things at once. And I glanced out the window, and I noticed clouds drifting by. And all of a sudden, my body just relaxed. I took a deep breath, which I hadn't for a while. And I noticed the clouds weren't racing the wind. They weren't dawdling. They were just going with the flow of the wind. And I just went, wow, I can live like that. And since then, my life has not been perfect. Sometimes I do get rushed. But for the most part, I tend to just go with the speed of things. Whatever's happening, kind of going with the speed of that. I learned that from just a cloud drifting by. In Sacred Journey of the Peaceful Warrior, the character Mama Chia teaches my character and says, Dan, you've heard the saying, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. Many people misinterpret that to think it means when the student is somehow deserving or prepared, a teacher will walk into their life and take them by the hand and lead them up the path. But she said what it means is when the student is ready, really prepared, the teacher appears everywhere. I remember an ancient saying that said, you have no friends, you have no enemies, you only have teachers. Every person, our children, our friends, our adversaries, people we like, people we don't like, all teach us. They're all potential lessons any moment of the day. And again, that's not a burden, that's just an opportunity. Because we'll learn lessons of life sooner or later.
Do you think, though, that there are ways, for example, if you become tuned into your body's felt sense in a situation or learn to monitor your breathing or different things like that, that you could start feeling in any given day when you're swimming against the current, so to speak?
Yes, of course. We can get sensitive enough where we can begin to feel what's going on inside our bodies. We begin to get messages, yes, no messages. Our body is very, very wise. It has a kind of instinctual wisdom, not a sophisticated intellectual wisdom, but an instinctive wisdom where we can make choices with our body. If we're deciding which car to buy, we can go and just touch each one, and we'll know. We can know. We don't have to have all the reasons why this car or look at all the spec sheets. There are different ways to make decisions. The conscious mind is only one way, and it's not usually the best way because our conscious mind doesn't always know the subtle variables that are going on, where our subconscious is in tune with things we're not fully aware of. I'm not anti-intellectual. I believe it's good to read the labels, you know, on foods, but also smell it, taste it, and get a feel for it. So I think eventually we function as a whole body. We function as a unity. Our intuition, our kinesthetic sense, our mental faculties, they work together. And then we begin to make decisions that are more instinctive and spontaneous and somehow feel more right to us than trying to figure out life all the time. Very few people have ever figured out what they're going to do in life for their career. We end up doing it. And if it doesn't work for us, we end up moving to something else until we feel like this feels right. It's a fit. It's a natural process. But those of us who want to have it all down in our heads, a certainty, well, the problem is not that we don't have a certainty. The problem is that we want a certainty because life isn't always that cut and dried.
It seems to me, Dan, that one of the things you're really uniquely qualified to speak about is the connection between athletics and sports and spirituality. And I'm very interested in this because I know some people who are athletes, and that's their connection to God. That's the language they would use. They're not meditators. They haven't read a bunch of spiritually oriented books or sacred texts. But when they go out and they run, they feel free and inspired. And I'm curious if you could comment some how accurate or how far-reaching are the experiences people have in athletic moments as spiritual insights.
Many of us in our lives dealing with the mundane issues of daily life feel perhaps bored or needing stimulation in life, so we seek experiences. We want magic to be alive in the world because we feel sometimes, or we miss appreciating the beauty of the floor we stand on or this moment. So athletes find powerful experiences in athletics on many different levels. Doing repetitive endeavors such as running or swimming is similar in some ways to drumming. It can develop altered states of consciousness, kind of a trance state where you feel very mellow and feel good and your creativity opens up, you get good ideas, a meditative state, dynamic meditation. Another viewpoint is there's a state I've operationally defined Satori, a little different from what it is in the Japanese tradition, but it's a state where the mind is quiet in the present moment, where the emotions are open and free-flowing, spontaneous, and the body's relaxed, sensitive, and alert. Well, we can access that state in sports just by throwing a ball back and forth, throwing a frisbee. You don't think about dinner or breakfast while you're reaching for a frisbee. You're in the present moment. So athletics is also a doorway to come back to the moment of truth, you know, that moment of silence, moment of truth, and live in the present intensely. Most athletes feel most alive when they're engaged in athletics, but musicians also feel that way when they're performing before a group. Time flies, your time sense changes. So athletics is a doorway to a number of different experiences, different brainwave patterns, and so on. But athletics, as structured, are also about focus on oneself, are also about competition. Football has been defined as a game in which you feel really good about half the players on the field. So there's an upside and a downside to athletics. It certainly beats just sitting around. It is, for many people, a wonderful avenue of personal growth. The idea of the Zen art, you know, the art of archery, Zen archery or Zen martial arts, using athletics as a means to personal growth. And in The Inner Athlete, I do approach sport in that way, to connect it to the bigger picture of our lives. Sport is like life, but more so. In the intensity of sport, it contains everything we deal with in life. Qualities of perseverance, living in the present moment, choices, responsibility, balance. All the laws apply directly to any athlete. The law of presence, the law of integrity, you know, following the rules, being honest and so on, being a good example to other people. Because there are athletes who are poor examples. There are athletes who are physically skilled, but they're not masters. Because they're only working for physical skill, they've lost sight of the bigger picture, they've lost perspective. They don't realize that sport is also a way to train the emotions and mind, and that carries outside the gymnasium walls or the athletic field. So every law of spirit applies to the athletic domain. So athletics are like a metaphor of life. There's a saying in the Zen tradition that if you can really serve a good cup of tea, you can do anything. And anybody who understands the tea ceremony really gets that. And in the same way, someone who becomes a master athlete in any field, including being a musician, a mime, a juggler, when you really connect it to the bigger picture and realize what I'm doing is life, that's when you've got something.
I wonder how much of that being in the flow that happens in sporting events or in athletics has to do with the actual chemical changes that are happening in your body as you're running or swimming. And, you know, also there are statistics about the chemical changes that occur when somebody's in meditation. And how much of understanding the laws of spirit is biochemically related?
Well, you know, usually when there's a question that seems to be an either or, the answer is generally both. Of course, when we exercise, our body heats up, aches and pains, we don't feel them as much. And yes, endorphins and different chemicals can come about. However, there are two kinds of athletes. Athlete A might be trying to prove him or herself to overcome a feeling of insecurity, who uses athletics to beat themselves up. And I was a coach. I've seen athletes like this. Every day in the gym is a way to punish themselves, push themselves into pain, get angry at themselves every time they don't meet their expectations. Athlete B might come in with a sense of joy, a constructive, purposeful sense of, I'd like to train today and challenge myself and see what I can do. Very different athletic experience. So one may be feeling more endorphins. That may affect their physiology as well. So to say it's physiology affecting consciousness or consciousness affecting physiology, I suspect it's both.
There was a moment in The Way of the Peaceful Warrior where you're in a gymnastic competition and you get this tremendous score and win the meet for the team. And, you know, when I was reading that, I got tears in my eyes, and I'm sure many readers do. And I feel similarly when I watch certain events on television. And I'm curious, what's happening at that moment that is so deeply moving and similar to some type of spiritual breakthrough.
Well, by the way, it did happen in real life exactly the way I described it in the book. Nothing fictional about that. We did win the national championships. I was the last performer up on the high bar. I did a movement in the routine that I'd never done before, except in practice, never done in competition. I pulled out all the stops in it. For me, I can relate exactly what it felt like. I felt like this was absolute moment of truth for me. And for the team, I had a larger purpose, my connection with the team. I stepped outside of myself. I felt like I could have torn that bar out of the floor if I needed to. There was a complete single-minded focus. There was no doubts coming up. Absolute determination. And I've learned to take at least aspects of that into the other parts of my life. I'm still learning. When the pressure was on, and it was considerable, I would describe it as a transcendent moment. And yet that doesn't make it more spiritual than any moment in time. This moment, right now, is equally important. See, it's easy for athletes to feel a special moment in the heat of competition or performance, but that's why I wrote No Ordinary Moments, as a reminder that every single moment is equally larger than life if we notice that. If it were our last moment, we'd certainly notice it. I tell a story in Peaceful Warrior about a man who was being chased by two tigers, and he jumps off a cliff and hangs from a single vine. And there are two tigers waiting below to devour him, and a rat comes down on the vine and starts gnawing at it just above his hand, and as it grows thinner and thinner, about to break, he notices a strawberry growing on the face of the cliff, and he plucks it. How sweet it tasted. If we knew that this moment might be our last, we'd just be hanging on to it like a special moment. I tell the story in No Ordinary Moments, something that happened to me in a previous book, that I was doing Tai Chi, you know, the slow-motion Chinese martial art, requiring some refined balance and relaxation and ease. And I noticed some people watching me. And as I finished this routine, I had shorts on. I'd been running, and I reached into my bag and started pulling on my longer sweatpants, and my foot got caught in the pants as I was thinking about the people watching me, and I fell over. And that's when I realized that putting my pants on was just as important as doing the Tai Chi routine. So that's one thing sports can teach us, only if we're paying attention, though.
This idea of being in the present, the law of presence, I've heard it recommended by many spiritual traditions that you learn how to meditate, and you mentioned this as well. Do you think that developing a meditation practice is essential? One can't skip that step? Or do you think that there are plenty of people who have figured out how to be present in each moment and never meditated?
Well, that's like saying people who want to become physically strong, it's been recommended that they do push-ups and sit-ups and work with weights. Some people might work with weights, some people might do calisthenics, but if they want to get strong, they do have to go through some kind of process where they challenge the muscles to grow stronger. I think our concepts of fitness have changed over the years. It used to be big muscles meant fitness, and men were considered more fit than women because they tended to have bigger muscles. Then we became wiser and we went deeper in the body, and we saw cardiovascular fitness, the lungs and nervous system, really defined fitness. So women were certainly at least equally fit as men. But I don't think we're finished yet. I think in the future we're going to go deeper into the body, and we're going to look at the nervous system and the hormonal system, the endocrine system, even deeper in the body, and we'll define that as fitness, a life that's stable, relaxed, centered, happy, sense of inner peace. That will be defined as ultimate fitness. And notice, the kind of fitness we see, that we desire, will determine the kind of exercises we do in order to become fit. So if strength is fitness, we do strength exercises. If cardiovascular endurance means fitness, we do aerobic exercises. If the health of the nervous system is fitness, we do things like yoga, relaxation exercises, breathing exercises, and meditation. One way to look at meditation is as a fitness exercise. Nobody has to do the same fitness exercise, but it does have specific results. I meditate just about every day, but I don't do it to get somewhere. I do it because I once asked myself, if I wanted to live an enlightened lifestyle, how would I act? What would I do during my day? Well, I knew I would spend part of my day with other people, relating with them, and part of my day in solitude. I'd spend part of my day active and part not active. Part of my day doing and part of my day just being. And meditation is one of the few times people have to consciously just be. Being asleep is different. but just sitting and feeling like you don't have to do anything in that moment, despite what thoughts are coming up, is very powerful. I see meditation as a practice of non-reactivity. Happy thoughts come up, sad thoughts come up, we just sit, balanced, and take the viewpoint of pure awareness, watching the thoughts come up. To me, this is a very useful practice, but only in the sense that we are able to bring it into daily life. If we just do it when we're sitting for a few minutes every day, that's very nice, but until it expands into everyday life, I think it's less useful.
You mentioned this question you asked yourself, how do I live an enlightened life? And this is a word that I think means a lot of different things to different people. What do you mean by enlightenment?
Well, I used to have an idea what enlightenment meant. I used to think I knew what spiritual meant. Now I have no idea, actually. I use it in a sense that most people understand it. Enlightenment used to mean, it can be defined as exploring the higher chakras, the higher energy centers, having mystical experiences out of the body or beyond the body, different blisses, senses of waves of happiness and okayness beyond our everyday feeling good, transcendental states that leave the world far behind because we realize our oneness with the universe. I've asked groups of people, what is enlightenment to you? And I hear about 20 or 30 different things. So, frankly, it doesn't really matter. All we can do is handle what's in front of us, put one foot in front of the other. I'm less concerned with enlightenment than just being as open and loving and kind as I can each day and face each moment with as much courage and as much love as I can bring to that moment. To me, personally, that's more meaningful than striving for something I call enlightenment.
One of the laws that's confusing to me that seems that there's a contradiction is between the law of choices, which says it's up to you to choose what happens in your life, and then the law of surrender, where you're clearly surrendering to a divine will, what goes on. And this is something that disturbs me probably on a daily basis. Do I lie down and ask for guidance, or do I do what I want to do? Sometimes it doesn't seem clear that there's not a contradiction there.
One of our primary evolutionary drives is the urge to happiness. And I don't mean that as a self-indulgent walking around with a gleeful smile on our face. It's almost beyond words. It's an inner guidance system that tells us this feels on and this feels off. On track, off track, somehow. Well, Abe Lincoln once said, when I do good, I feel good. When I do bad, I feel bad. That's my religion. So we have this internal guidance system. So on one hand, and there's always a one hand and another hand, we need to follow our desires on the highest level. Not in the sense of the Buddhist desires mean suffering, but our heart's desire, our deepest desire. And most people aren't even in touch with that anymore. Let me relate it this way. You talked about the law of choices and the law of surrender as apparent contradictions. The law of choices implying we can simply choose to do this or choose to do that. In other words, exert our will. And the law of surrender doesn't seem to be about exerting our will, but yet it is, because it's about exerting our will of how we'll creatively make best use of the present moment and looking at it for the highest good of all concerned rather than what's in my best interest, what do I need or prefer, to what's for the highest good of all. So it's a higher will. It's surrendering to a higher will, and it's making a choice on that basis. It's still making a choice. We can look at the law of surrender and say, this is what would be for the highest good of all concerned, and I choose to do that, or I choose not to. We're still applying the law of choices. Whatever we do, we're choosing to do. Nobody's making us do it. So it's more of a paradox than a contradiction in terms. You might also bring up the title of a previous book, The Life You Were Born to Live. That
exactly.
Sounds like predestination.
Exactly, as you were talking about numerology. Okay, I've been given this set of numbers or this astrology report. And yet you're saying that I can choose who I am or how I am in the world, but yet, on the other hand, you're telling me I have a set of numbers that dictate to me.
Well, it sounds like that. I don't know how many redwood trees there are in the world. And knowing something is a redwood tree, we can say certain things about it. Redwood trees have certain characteristics different from other kinds of trees. On the other hand, no single redwood tree is exactly like any other redwood tree in the world. I could say that I think most people would accept that. I haven't checked them all. Just like snowflakes, all different, slightly. That's how people are. So nobody is defined by a number, and I explain that in the book quite thoroughly. They simply refer to a frequency, a vibration, certain issues. And so I don't presume to know you or anyone else if I know their birth number, but I can say things about the energies that they're working, the issues they will be working in their own unique way. So when I say the life you were born to live, it sounds like predestination. And yet, what about free will? Again, both are true in the sense that we are given a ballpark to play in, but the games we play in that park and how we play them are up to us. We're given a particular mountain to climb based on our birth number, but what route we take up that mountain, the pace we take, whether we want to stop and say this is as high as I'm going, that's all subject to free will. And that's what makes the human being unique, because they have the free will. Animals live on instinct mostly, but human beings can make choices and do make choices every day. And so we're working within a certain kind of predestination. Can you imagine if we had to work with all of the issues intensely of all the birth numbers? People would be going crazy. So spirit has a way of focusing us to a certain place in time. We can't live every place at once. We can't be with everybody at once. Each person is a hologram. Each place we live in the world is a hologram of any place. We can work out whatever we need to work out in a spiritual sense with a particular person, with any person in a sense. Whoever we choose is the person we're meant to be with at that time. So I hope that helps resolve somewhat this idea, the apparent contradiction between free will and making choices. Both are true. Free will and predestination.
Dan, you talked about how you don't fit into any specific religious tradition. You've created the peaceful warrior tradition, in a sense, or synthesized that tradition for many. Has that ever felt frustrating to you? You know, I wish I could identify a certain spiritual path, a certain set of practices that were, you know, part of a thousand-year-old lineage. Here it is. I'm part of a lineage.
Well, I guess I've always been somewhat of an individualist. I came from gymnastics, which is a kind of individualistic sport. So whenever masses of people have gravitated in one direction, I've tended to gravitate in the opposite direction. And that's just one of those eccentricities or peculiarities about my character. Not good or bad, it's just part of my own personality makeup. So I don't know that I felt frustrated, but I felt, as I said, kind of alone at times. I didn't have the comfort of falling back on a particular dogma, belief system. And because I don't identify with any particular religion, it leaves me free to embrace them all, which I feel I do. To paraphrase the words of Will Rogers, I don't think I've ever met a religion I didn't like at its heart, at its core. And even though they're not exactly the same, different fingers pointing at the moon, so to speak, I do embrace the ways of science, the ways of mysticism, the ways of Judaism, the ways of Christianity, Sufism, Islam. Every religion and tradition has great value. And that's the wonderful thing about life. That's why there are more than one book in the library, because there's not one book for everybody. We have a variety of needs. We're at different places in our life. I see kind of metaphor of life, the way we pick books when we go into a bookstore. I don't know about you, but I go into a kind of a trance state, alpha, when I walk into a bookstore. I'm not all there. I kind of drift through the aisles. And if I'm looking for a book, but I don't know which one, just kind of drifting the aisles, I want to get a book. Sometimes, you know, we'll pass by a book because we've already been there. It's history to us. Other times we pass by a book because we're not ready for it yet. We literally can't see it. But when we pick a book that's just right for us in that moment, that's a magical thing that happens. It's a mystical process, picking a book. But it's no terribly different from how we end up sometimes, where we live, or the people we end up with. Whether we figure it's perfect for us and they make us as happy as we'd like, whether we have personality conflicts. I don't know anybody who doesn't. My wife and I have a good relationship and we fight a lot. That's just part of life, but everything serves for our highest good in learning. I'm absolutely convinced of it, and that anybody who looks at their life in that perspective comes to that point of knowing what they already knew but forgot.
You have a metaphor, though, that life is a school. This is a training ground. Therefore, it's all about learning. That's the way that you see the world. Now, do you think of that as a metaphor, or do you think that's actually the way it is? Is this just, I mean, this idea that it's a school or a training ground, not everybody sees it that way.
Well, maybe life is complete chaos and random events, and nothing means anything, and we just happen to find ourselves through forces beyond our control, and we make a few choices. And maybe it means nothing. Maybe we live and have kids or not have kids and get married and live and die. But, you know, anybody who's seen a flower open or a sunset or the stars pass overhead and felt wonder knows that somehow it just can't be. I don't need that. That's not an opiate for me. It's not a hopeful belief that I need. Hey, if life is chaos, great. I'll live chaotic. And we'll enjoy ourselves as much as possible. But there seems to be a structure. As Einstein said, God does not play dice with the universe. And he looked into these laws deeply. He's a mystic, Einstein, not just a scientist. And so anybody who has really wondered about life and stared into the mystery can't help but think that there is a purpose for our living. There's something very big and wondrous going on, even with the tragedies and the joys of life as they come and go. And so what makes the most sense to me is that life is a school and we're here to learn. And we learn easy lessons or they get harder. But we'll eventually learn whatever we need to awaken to who we are, to our unity, to love, to everything we're striving for, to all our ideals. This way of the peaceful warrior is not something I made up. I didn't know what to call my book, but I knew something about the warriors, their appreciation in a sense of becoming masters. They knew that the physical skills alone weren't enough in life. Life is technique. Part of it is technique. But there's the mind and the emotions, which form a whole greater than the sum of the parts we call spirit. So it was something about that warrior lineage that this is the moment of truth. And yet it wasn't just about warriors, it was about peaceful warriors. And that's how the term came up. But I've never seen anybody who isn't a peaceful warrior. It's not a private club that you can join, it's not something I made up. Only the most courageous souls came down to this planet, where we have friction and gravity and death, to learn. This is the realm of the peaceful warriors. Many people have forgotten that courage and love inside them. But we can remind each other. That's one of our purposes for being here, just to remind each other.
When you say that nobody is excluded from, everyone is a peaceful warrior.
In training.
What do you mean by that? I mean, clearly there's a lot of people who would listen to you and say, excuse me, I don't even want to be included in, as one of your peaceful warriors. That does not apply to me.
Right. Well, it depends on their meaning, because many people have associations with the term warrior, imagining it means fighting and opposition. But remember, Jesus didn't say there are no enemies or don't have enemies. He said, love your enemies. He recognized we do have adversaries. Anytime you have a belief, there are people who have a different belief. So we all have adversaries in life. But the way of the peaceful warrior is not so much about fighting an external opponent or enemy. It's about the battle we have inside. Our sparring partners are fear, insecurity, self-doubt. Those things that keep us from stepping fully into life and living the life we were born to live. That's why I call it the way of the peaceful warrior. That's why it's about all of us, whether someone chooses to identify with the word warrior or not. It's recognizing that we're here to learn courage and love in this life. And that's what the peaceful warrior's way is about. It's not my way. It's not a church. It has no dogma. If I ever start a church, I'll probably call it the Born Yesterday Church of Occasional Clarity. It has a certain ring to it.
Now, don't you think that the great religious traditions that are thousands and thousands of years old, they've thought through all of these spiritual laws and that they're available to us to connect with whatever religious tradition we were born into or one of the ancient religious traditions? Why have an affiliation with something that Dan Millman, a guy in his, 50 years old, developed Mr. Synthesis today? I mean, I would rather be Jewish or Hindu or Buddhist, these traditions that have been tested over thousands and thousands of years.
Well, I don't know how to answer that. Maybe so. I'm not here to sell people on, this way of the peaceful warrior. I simply write books and lecture, and for those who are interested, I'm like radio station peaceful warrior. Some people tune into one radio station, and some people tune into another. Maybe 100 years from now, someone will look back and say, gee, Dan Millman was a great teacher. And maybe not. I have no perspective. It's all a mystery to me. I'm just doing what I'm moved to do. To me, it's a more of a brand X, a more of a generic approach to spirituality. It's not in any way that I can see an opposition to the Jewish tradition, the Hindu tradition. There are Hindu peaceful warriors, Jewish peaceful warriors, Christian peaceful warriors. Again, it's about all of us. It's just a way of appreciating the courage and the love we have inside of us. All of us who've lived a certain amount of time know that life can be like a battle at times. It requires courage and stability and commitment and strength. It also requires love and kindness and compassion. That's what I call a peaceful warrior. It's not an exclusive thing separate from Judaism or Christianity or anything else. I think someone who's truly aligned with any of the traditions, which had a beginning and developed over time around usually a teacher, I think that's wonderful. And I would never recommend somebody who says, I'm really happy with a Jewish tradition or a Christian tradition. I would say, well, great. Well, that's wonderful. Have a great day. What I teach is not different, as far as I can see, from the core. I mean, what is different about recognizing there are no ordinary moments and to live in the present and to follow the laws of spirit? This seems to be common to every religion and a mainstream tradition. But yet, we also have to take a loving and appreciative, but also an open-eyed look at traditions that may have worked for many, many years, but have since become a little lost in dogmas that may not reflect the original thoughts and views of the teachers around which these traditions were founded. So we also have to take a look at what is getting back to basics, to appreciate all the traditions.
You jokingly referred to the Way of the Peaceful Warrior as generic brand X. And in speaking with you, I can see that you have tremendous esoteric knowledge of all kinds of systems, and yet you seem to choose to present your ideas in a relatively simplistic fashion. Is that a choice that you're making? You're consciously saying, I want to present material that will have the most appeal to as many people as possible, so I'm not going to present these ideas in esoteric ways.
Well, I've always believed that simple is powerful because we're more likely to make use of what is simple. I'm not here to have people trust me. I'm here to help them trust themselves. I'm not here for people to be impressed with me, but to be impressed with themselves, their potential. Yes, I do make light of my approach to life because I think humor is very important. I often describe myself as a blend between Ram Dass and Haagen-Dazs, or the Reader's Digest of spiritual teachings. And yet there may be some profundity to it. I think it comes down to fundamental principles. And sometimes they're simple and sometimes they're not as simple. I've read a certain number of esoteric texts, and I've had to wade through like a swamp. I've had to wade through enculturated terms and terminology and views to get to the core, to the germ of truth that you can actually apply. I mean, I can talk about the etheric and the causal and the astral dimensions, but what do you do with that? I once taught a trampoline clinic with a friend of mine, and he was a physics major. And he spoke about the moment of inertia and the radius of rotation and the conservation of angular momentum. And by the end of his little talk about trampoline, everyone was terribly impressed with how intelligent he was. But that was not my goal. When I spoke, my goal was, how can I help these people listening to be better at trampoline? So I would speak in much simpler terms. And in some ways, I suppose I haven't been taken, perhaps in some quarters, as seriously as people who are degreed in, you know, PhDs or come from one tradition and speak in terms of the Dharma and wear the robes and whatnot. We're all human beings. I've got my eccentricities. I work from my heart. And when I'm doing so, there's a certain energy. I did not in any way consciously say, I want to keep my teaching very simple so I can reach out to the most number of people, but maybe subconsciously that was the motive behind my style of writing. I'm a very simple person. I'm not an intellectual. There are people who write novels that are so brilliant and arcane and complex that I don't know that I'm capable necessarily or even interested in doing it just like that. I'm a storyteller, not a novelist, really. I love to tell stories, more a Washington Irving than a Fyodor Dostoevsky. And because I'm fairly simple in my own approach to life, like a hobbit in a way, I just communicate things in a way that I can understand and appreciate to get real outcomes in life. On the other hand, I try not to make it simplistic. To me, there's a difference between simple and simplistic. H.L. Mencken once said that for every complex problem, there's a simple solution that doesn't work. So I don't say that simple is the answer to everything. Einstein once said, make everything as simple as you can and not one bit simpler. So finding that balance again, not too simple, not oversimplified where we lose accuracy, but just enough to convey the concept, the germ of a concept that people can take with them and go and use.
You've been spending some time presenting laws that change lives, the laws of spirit, to groups of people. And I wonder if there's a kind of warning or a way that you see people misinterpreting the material quite regularly, certain pitfall that people fall into.
Well, we as human beings tend to look at the world through a window of our own interpretations, thoughts, associations, and beliefs. And we also hear the world through that window. You know, in a relationship, how sometimes you say something and someone seems to hear something very different from what you meant? because we also have filters through which we hear the world. Anything that can be understood can be misunderstood and often will be. So my aim, as much as possible, has not been to be understood, but to be impossible to be misunderstood. That may be too idealistic a goal, though, because I'm certain that some of the things I've written will be interpreted by some people to mean something different from what I intended. So what I try to do is at least explain a law to the degree where people can get the concept of it. And if they don't, it's good for them to contemplate it. What does it mean to them? It's less important what it means to me than what it means to the listener or the reader. Many times we hear one thing, then we hear it again, then we hear it again, and we hear it the fifth time and we get it at a deeper level. One of the dangers in spiritual life or any kind of gathering of wisdom is the danger of that phrase, I know it already. If we think we know something already, we may be deceiving ourselves, because the way we know is we know it, then we know it deeper, then we know it deeper.
You've mentioned the word courage a couple of times, and that's a word that I think is so beautiful. Don't hear it very much. And yet I wonder, do you think courage is something people are born with, or that they choose, they can develop? You know, some people just sort of seem naturally courageous. You think they were born that way. That's just sort of part of who they are.
My own view is that we all have fears. Courage is not the absence of fear. In a sense, it's the conquering of it. That's part of the battleground of the peaceful warrior. We only have a chance to show courage in the face of fear, and the more fear, the more courage we can show. There was one gentleman who wrote to me once and said, well, I tried to do a challenge and I failed. And I said, well, what challenge was it? He said, well, I had to climb this telephone pole up in the woods and climb up on top and then leap off to and catch a trapeze. And I said, well, did you climb the pole? He said, well, yes. I said, well, did you stand up on it? He said, uh-huh. And I said, well, did you turn and leap off and grab the trapeze? He said, yes. I said, well, I may be missing something here. He said, well, I didn't show courage. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I was afraid the whole time. And, of course, he didn't really understand. Maybe we project on other people. We see gymnasts or stunt people or daredevils, and we go, oh, they have no fear. Even the word fearless, to me, isn't always accurate. I've been terrified many times. I used to be scared every single day in the gym. I'd be trying a new stunt I could break my neck on. And so to me, fear was just something you look at, say, well, thank you very much, and get on with it. So I learned courage. It's something you learn over time when you realize you can do it. Many people who haven't had a chance to do that through a sport or whatever end up feeling that thing they call fear, and that to them means, no, don't do this. Fear is a wonderful servant, but a terrible master. So courage is something we can all draw upon in ourselves. For example, a mother may be terrified of a big, burly mugger in front of her. But if that mugger is about to injure her child, she's going to find out what courage is. She may say, no, I wasn't courageous, I was terrified. But she'll respond in a way to protect her child that anyone else would say was absolutely courageous. It doesn't mean the absence of fear. Courage is a response to life. It takes courage just to live in this world. It takes courage to risk loving anybody. There are great dramatic ways to overcome fear. You know, we have firewalks and we have rock climbing and rappelling and skydiving and bungee jumping. These are very dramatic ways, but the most important ways are what we face every day. The courage to risk rejection. Telling someone we like them and they may not say the same back to us. Expressing what we really feel when it's kind of scary for us. Expressing who we are, what we need. Saying, world, like it or not, this is who I am. That takes a lot of courage, too. Being ourself, instead of other people's expectations of who we should be.
So you would go along with the saying, feel the fear and do it anyway?
Absolutely.
That could be a Dan Millman type saying.
Well, it's a spiritual law in the form of a book title.
Mm-hmm. Now, I guess part of my question is the difference between the person who feels fear and says, uh-uh, than the person who feels fear and goes ahead.
Well, you know, we have to be gentle with ourselves as well, because sometimes we're just not up to it in a particular moment in our life. But when we're not up to it, there's a part of us that says, you know, I still need to learn that. And next time, the old idea, you fall off a horse, you got to get back on. Next time, maybe they will be up to it. So we're all learning. Everything serves in its own way. We shouldn't beat ourselves up or judge ourselves because fear stopped us. Fear stopped all of us at times, hundreds of times. But each time we overcome any fear, we realize next time we can do it a little bit easier. Because the sky doesn't fall, and it actually works.
Now, do you think it's fair to say that the purpose of our lives, the purpose of the Earth, is this learning process? Is that accurate?
Well, let's put it this way. I don't know about what the purpose is. I can make up a purpose, and it makes me feel good to think of that as a purpose, to learn, to grow more in courage and love, to awaken. These are all beautiful metaphors that have some truth for me. But the question maybe could be phrased, how do we make best use of our time here? We spend 24 hours a day.
How do we make best use of our time here,
Dan? I'm glad you asked that. Tammy, I couldn't say. I can only say how I make best use of my time, and it's living to the best of my abilities in line with what I teach. You know, they say, teach what you need to learn. Well, after writing 8 books so far and counting, I must have a lot I need to learn. So I think a good way to make use of our time is to use it to grow and to serve and to remember. That's what Ram Dass had in one of his books, Love, Serve, and Remember.
Remember what?
Love God, serve God, remember God and everybody. And again, that's not a religious statement. I'm not coming from a particular religious tradition. It's whatever God means to us. To me, it's a mystery. That mystery, that wonder in life. Beyond the mind. Beyond our daily life. That transcendental reality. That's what I call God, and to somebody else might be very different.
This word transcendental, that's a beautiful word too. What does that mean to you, transcendental reality?
Well, it's only a word until someone has had a moment, and most of us have, whether we remember them or not, where suddenly everything is okay, despite what's going on, despite if our body's in pain, despite if we've just gone broke and have no money, no matter what circumstances are going on in our life, life feels absolutely wonderful. And that is a transcendental moment. It transcends conditional happiness. It brings up unconditional love. And maybe if there's one reason people have enjoyed Where the Peaceful Warrior, it's because it reminds people, yes, it's okay. Whatever it seems like, whatever life appears to be at this moment, whatever problems we're dealing with, life is going to be okay. It's more than okay. It's absolutely fantastic.